Okay, for the sake of the tape, I should say that this is Imaging Black Women, Hollywood and the Independents. The images that you'll see here, for the most part, fall into several different categories. The mulatto, the mammy, the vamp, which almost always was a light-skinned beauty. High yaller, no, she was known as usually. The good woman, who is kind of an offshoot of the mammy servant character and almost always dark-skinned. She even looked a little bit like that mammy figure. I'll give you a definition of that a little bit later, but I'm sure you already know that. And the entertainer. What's important to remember is that these images of blacks appeared in Hollywood films before black actresses played the roles. That is, they were played by whites in blackface. They were not invented by the filmmakers. Not even D.W. Griffith invented these figures, these stereotypes. They were in the culture at the time. Now, it's true that once they get on screen, they become etched in concrete for us. But nonetheless, these were already with us. There was in Hollywood a fascination very early on with Mrs. Stowe's novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin. There have been over 24 different versions of Uncle Tom's Cabin made by Hollywood. These include short films, things like Topsy and Eva. There's a film called Uncle Tom's Cabana, a little animation. There are very serious Uncle Tom's Cabins films. In fact, in 1903, you really see the first one. It was put on screen really like a filmed play. That is, you see little tableaus, but the Uncle Tom is there and played by a white actor in blackface. Now, what I have for you here in the first slide, I think, is one version of Uncle Tom's Cabin. Now, bear in mind that there had been four versions before Birth of a Nation in 1915. So this is only one of those. 1903 was the first one, 1910, 1913, and 1914. And this is the 1914 one.
Oh, yeah. What are you doing? Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Now, what you see is Tom here with his eyes to the heavens, and Cassie, who was a mulatto, as was Liza. You remember Liza crossing the ice? And they're played, both of these roles, by white actors. The tragic mulatto stereotype comes directly from literature. She, and it usually was she, was tragic by virtue of being a product of miscegenation, by being almost white, yet still a slave, and by not belonging to one race or the other. Birth of a Nation added another Philip. The evil mulatto, that is, one male and one female, Silas Lynch and Lydia Brown, who were tragic only to the extent that their black blood somehow made them inherently evil. Unfortunately, I don't have a slide to show you of those two. In the next slide, D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, you see the typical mammy played by white actress Jenny Lee. She looks like she's well padded there, as you can see, and she always was a big woman, big bosomed and big everywhere else, aproned and head ragged, obstreperous and domineering. And you see her here, she's usually domineering over males, and here she's telling off the northern servant of the Honorable Austin Stoneman. In 1922, D.W. Griffith made One Exciting Night, and you see here on the right the male character, Porter Strong, who actually made his living in Hollywood by playing actors, by playing roles in blackface. The servant, the female character here, she has a bit of the upstairs maid influence, you notice. They are both of these roles are played for comic relief. and you can see that the two of them, I don't know whether you can tell, but they are ancillary to the major plot of the film, but they are very typically frightened of anything that might be unexplained. The darkness, anything that comes along, you know, these sort of ghostly figures, they are immediately terrified, and the roles are played broadly for comic relief. This is actually a still photograph from another Uncle Tom's Cabin, which was still a silent film, but a black actor and actress, as you can see, are both playing these roles, and James B. Lowe on the left was the first black actor actually ballyhooed by Hollywood as the Uncle Tom, and he traveled with the film. The only earlier black Uncle Tom was Sam Lucas. Here he is with James Lowe with Gertrude Howard as Chloe, and you can see that she's the mammy type here. But the consummate mammy was Hattie McDaniel, and here's her famous role for which she won the Academy Award for the Best Supporting Actress. She made about 200 films in Hollywood and was criticized for playing the mammy role or playing the servant, and her famous rejoinder to that was, "I'd rather be a maid in the movies for $7,000 a week than a maid in somebody's kitchen for $7. The role here is pretty much the same. She's with Ben Carter the next year, 1940, in Maryland, and she's not dressed too differently from the way she was in Gone with the Wind. Here she is in a publicity photo with Ben Carter. In 1943, well, that's okay. You can see enough of James Cagney, I think, to recognize him, and Johnny Come Lately. And here she is with Shirley Temple in 1944 and with Jean Crane in 1946 in Margie. Now, there was another black woman actress who played these roles of following Hattie McDaniel, and in fact, some of them in the 40s at the time of McDaniel's popularity. She did not play the mammy role. She was this mammy variant, the good maid. There are a number of the same characteristics, although she was always much less obstreperous than Hattie McDaniel. This is her famous role as Delilah in 1934. In Imitation of Life, where she played with Claudette Colbert. This is an adaptation of Imitation of Life by Fanny Hurst, which was an extremely popular, really feminist novel that showed two women raising their daughters alone and coming together in a very interesting kind of experience. Now, in that novel, Miss B, and here you see her here played by Claudette Colbert, Miss B chooses the life that she's, in a sense, forced into to become a woman alone working to support both her father and her daughter. But in the film, the great struggle is resolved when she gets the man and also gets the recipe from Louise Beaver's Delilah, her maid. This is the famous sequence with Ned Sparks. They've already made the money on the pancake recipe, and Miss B wants to give Delilah a home of her own and give her a percentage. But Delilah says no, she just wants to be with Miss B, and she doesn't want to move out into her own home. And Ned Sparks says, "Once a pancake, always a pancake," which draws a great laugh from the crowd. Louise Beavers went on to make a number of films pretty much in the same mold. Here she is in Rainbow on the River in 1936 with Bobby Breen, who was a child singing star. She is with Carol Lombard in this one, Made for Each Other, and a publicity still here in her famous servant outfit. Notice the fingernails. She could hardly wash many dishes with those with that kind of manicure, but the role she played fit that dishwashing background. This is a woman named Lois Gardella, and as late as 1933, she was playing Mammy in Stand Up and Cheer, that is a white singer playing the role of a black woman in films. And she was billed in that film, not under her own name, but as Mammy. And here is Butterfly McQueen, who is still alive and well and living in New York, in her famous role as Prissy, which is a variant of the servant role, but with Butterfly McQueen's own unique capabilities, her talents, that special voice that she had. Here she is in a scene with Gregory Peck in Duel in the Sun. Now, there are a whole series of black women who came into films via another medium, who had been popular or who had begun careers in the theater or on stage or in nightclubs. This is Nina Mae McKinney, and when King Vidor was ready to make his first talking film, he selected an all-black film. He was very interested in making an all-black cast film. He had to convince the studio and, in fact, put his own money into it in order to make this film. And he found Nina Mae McKinney in the Cotton Club chorus line. She was 16 years old. And here she is with Daniel Haynes in Hallelujah, a film which has become a film classic, actually. And here she is. You can probably tell that she is the vamp, and she is light-skinned and has very little moral sense. This is not necessarily immoral, but certainly amoral. And she usually, as the vamp, does something to seduce the good young man. And she doesn't win out in this, but the seduction takes place. And the triangle here is with the good black woman, and it's played in this film by Victoria Spivey. And of course everything comes out all right because Nina Mae McKinney gets killed before the end of the film. There was another all-black cast film made in Hollywood that same year. Some directors were convinced that although white actors were having problems making the transition to sound, that the resonance of black voices would be much better for talkies. And this is this actor's first role on the right. We're not going to talk about him today, but this is Stephen Fetchett in Hearts and Dixie. And this is the good woman here, dressed pretty much the way the original Mammy was, and she literally works herself to death for her husband. Now, this I just want to show you that Nina Mae McKinney actually had a brief role with an important black actor. It was not this film was not made in America. It was made in England, and this is Paul Robeson in Sanders of the River. But notice the native garb, which recalls a sort of classic Tarzan Africa. In 1949, Nina Mae McKinney is the bad woman again in a film called Pinky with Jean Crane, and she's also with Frederick O'Neill in this film in a bit role. After 1934 and The Imitation of Life, in which a black woman played the role of the tragic mulatto. Hello? There. Let's see if I can go back one and see. Yeah. This is Freddie Washington playing with Louise Beavers, who was her mother, in Imitation of Life as the young woman who wants desperately to pass and who rejects her race and her mother literally dies of a broken heart. That was the last time that a black woman actually was offered the role as the tragic mulatto. This is a publicity still of Freddie Washington. She also had a role again with Paul Robeson in an independently made film, The Emperor Jones, in 1933. Most of these very talented women were not able to sustain a real career in film, even if the film they made was extremely well received, because the color problem. And Lena Horne tells some interesting stories about that herself. Here's Pinky with Jean Crane, a white actress, playing the role of the tragic mulatto with Ethel Waters, so that Freddie Washington nor Nina Mae McKinney was able to get that job. Here she is again in the Pinky role. Ethel Waters came into film. She already had a reputation in the theater and on the musical stage, so she was a known quantity when she came into Hollywood, but she still was forced to play some of these maid's roles. Here she is with Jeanette MacDonald in a film called Cairo in 1942, but she played herself in Stage Door Canteen in 1943. And here she is as the good woman in the Ultimate Triangle with Lena Horne playing the bad woman, the vamp, and the battle here is over Eddie Anderson, who was known in with Jack Benny as Rochester. Oh, sorry, I want to go forward, don't I? Ethel Waters went back to the theater and made The Member of the Wedding on stage an extremely popular piece with Julie Harris, and they both took it to Hollywood. What's interesting about that particular film is that Ethel Waters, because of her reputation, was able to make changes, to insist on changes in the script, and talked to Carson McCullers about it and was able to change the character she played in Member of the Wedding. She wanted the woman not to be a drinker and not to be lustful, and she isn't, if you've seen that film. And here she is with Yul Brynner and Joanne Woodward in an adaptation of Sound and the Fury, the Faulkner novel, in 1959. Now, Lena Horne was the first black woman to manage a contract with a major studio in Hollywood. I don't know whether you've seen her one-woman show, but she's gotten a lot of this, a lot of these feelings about these experiences off her chest by talking about them with audiences. And one of the things that upset her most was when they were going to do a remake of Showboat. She said, "Here I was, under contract, I got on the bullet train and went west and expected that I was going to be the tragic mulatto in the remake of Showboat, and they had already hired Ava Gardner to do it." I think that's one of the things that she found extremely hard to accept. Here she is in The Duchess of Idaho. One of the ways that they handled Lena Horne in Hollywood was, she said, to pose her up against an alabaster pillar where she could sing and have her scenes, but when the film went south, they could just excise her scenes from the film. She's not the only actress who had that experience. But in 1943, she made two films, both starring roles, and here she is in Cabin in the Sky with Eddie Anderson, and here she is with Fats Waller in Stormy Weather, and her star in that film was Bill Bojangles Robinson. She was also in 1944 in The Ziegfeld Follies, and in 1945 in Broadway Rhythm with Eddie Anderson. And here she is, not posed against the pillar, but you can see that whole nightclub scene could be lifted out. And here, in as late as 1969, she is still somewhat the tragic mulatto, although the love affair is consummated here. But it's okay, because the gunfighter dies, so there's no really, you know, no big problem about it. This is Dorothy Dandridge, one of the most beautiful women in Hollywood films in the 40s, late 40s and early 50s. She also came from the musical stage, and she is one of the few who actually received an Oscar nomination for a major role. That is, the starring female role, not best supporting actress. And I'm sure you know that no black actress has received an Oscar for the outstanding best actress role. Here Dorothy Dandridge is with the Nicholas brothers, one of whom she married in 19... 19- This is 1941, Sun Valley Serenade. And she's with Louis Armstrong here in Pillow to Post in 1946. And in Bright Road with a very young Harry Belafonte, his first film. Neither of these is a stereotypical role, very unusual. They're both young school teachers. Well, I shouldn't say not stereotypical. He's the principal and she's the teacher. So, you know, you can draw your conclusions about that one. But this is the role for which she was nominated as Best Actress, Carmen Jones, in 1954. And she is with Belafonte and Joe Adams in this film. Oh, she's with two other important actresses who also had gone on to have roles in film. Diane Carroll over here on my right and Pearl Bailey. Incidentally, in this film, you know, it was an adaptation of the opera Carmen, which had been made into a stage play as Carmen Jones, a musical, and then was adapted by Preminger to film. Most of the singing roles were dubbed. Pearl Bailey is the only one who sings in her own voice in this film. And this is Island in the Sun. Now, there are two interracial love affairs, or seem to be love affairs, in this film. One is Harry Belafonte and Joan Fontaine, and he's made comments about how he could hardly touch her in the film. But John Justin, the British actor, and Dorothy Dandridge actually have a relationship, marry, and live, we think, as in Hollywood, happily ever after. But the saving grace in all of this, of course, is that it's really an island. It doesn't have anything to do with mainland USA. That may have been why it was acceptable. Here she is in Porgy and Bess with Sidney Poitier, and in Tamango with Kurt Jurgens. But here she's the savage beauty, or the kind of native vamp. I should say, Donald Bogle, the black film critic, whose work has, I think, been around for enough time now for people to get these five stereotypes in their minds. He called his historical interpretation of film, blacks in film, Toms, Coons, Mulattoes, Mammies, and Bucks. And he discusses Dorothy Dandridge as a woman who, in a sense, lived out this problem of the tragic mulatto in her own life. She died very young, in her early 40s, from an overdose of sleeping pills. And I think that one of the major problems in her life was what to do with this career, which seemed to be going somewhere and never quite did. Other entertainers that came in to film, Hazel Scott is here with Lena Horne. And Hazel Scott was usually posed with her piano, as Horne was with her alabaster pillar. And here's the great Catherine Dunham, who also came into a couple of films, but played in general, played herself. That's a shot of Catherine Dunham. And here is Eartha Kitt, whose first film was in the 50s, called New Faces. And Eartha Kitt did have a fairly, not a long career, but she did at least have a career in film. She's in Anna Lucasta here, which was originally about a Polish woman and became in film a black experience. Here she is with Sammy Davis Jr. and with Nat King Cole in St. Louis Blues. This is Diane Carroll, and she was in the film Carmen Jones, but here she is in a brief role in Porgy and Bess. And here she is in The Split with Jim Brown during the period that we now call the blaxploitation period of the 70s. And this is what most people think was her best role in 1973 in the film Claudine with James Earl Jones. Now, some women came from the theater to Hollywood, and Ruby Dee is one of these. She traveled, in fact, in classical theater, and I remember seeing her in one of the Greek plays very early in the 50s. She was in a number of films. Here she is with the real Jackie Robinson in The Jackie Robinson Story in 1950, and with this young man in Take a Giant Step in 1960, and in the adaptation of Lorraine Hansberry's A Raisin in the Sun with Claudia McNeil, who had come over from the theater. And here she is with Diana Sands in that same film. She also played in Gone Are the Days with her husband Ossie Davis as an adaptation of Pearly Victorious, his play, and in Uptight with Gina Mayfield, and she worked on the script of this film. Now, one of the things that we don't get to see very often is black women actually being involved in the screenwriting process or in directing. Here she is in Buck and the Preacher with Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte. One of the things that Ruby Dee complained about was not that she wasn't in films with these very attractive men, but that she never really got close to them. That is, the so-called romantic scenes never included any real romance. Now, there are others who came from the theater into film. And let me make a gigantic leap backwards here to tell you that Evelyn Prier was one of the stars of the Lafayette Players in Harlem. And during that early period, Oscar Michaud made films on the East Coast using those dramatic actors and actresses who were in close proximity to him and his shooting, because he was the only black filmmaker who started as an independent, stayed as an independent, but whose career actually went over two decades, from the early 20s to the 40s. And Oscar Michaud was smart enough to use some of these people who had experience in the theater, not necessarily before the camera, but then Michaud didn't have any experience before the camera either. He just jumped into it. And when the Johnson brothers began making their films as early as 1916 and asked him for this novel, The Homesteader, he wanted to direct it, even though he had never directed a film before. When they said no, he said, then I'll make my own films. And that's what he did. And this is Evelyn Prier in The Homesteader. And here she is in The Brute with another actor from the Lafayette Players. And this is Lawrence Chennault. Anita Bush, who started her own theater company, also appeared in films, in two films that were made by an independent white film company, the Norman Motion Picture Manufacturing Company, in, of all places, Jacksonville, Florida, in the 20s. They made about a half a dozen all-black cast films, and Anita Bush was the star of two of them, one, The Crimson Skull, and the other one, The Bulldogger. Now, there were other companies that starred blacks in all-black cast films, especially for black audiences in segregated theaters. And this is the Herald Picture Company, which was located in New York City. And this one is with Sheila Guise and was made in 1947. It's called Miracle in Harlem. Although Michaud attempted to show an alternative experience, that is, a black experience that was alternative to what Hollywood was showing, he also used some of the notions of Hollywood. So here you have the woman that he billed as the sepia Mae West, Bee Freeman, in a film called The Underworld, which he made in 1936. And Michaud, who wanted to show to depict mainly middle-class characters and attractive black characters, was himself accused of doing some stereotyping. And here is his, what he called his Negro Harlow, Ethel Moses in a publicity shot. And actually, I never saw a film with Ethel Moses that looked anything like that. She played a school teacher in his film called God's Stepchildren in the 40s, and she wasn't draped this way, I can tell you. But you can see that he is, in his own way, conforming to what was the notion of women in Hollywood films. This is a shot from Julie Dash's film Illusions. There are among the black independents a group of very interesting black women who are making films on both coasts, New York as well as Los Angeles. Julie Dash is one from UCLA, and this is her film called Illusions. What's interesting about the film is that there are two women who are central to it, the protagonist and this young woman who is a blues singer. And the notion in that film is that black women can control their own lives even though they're exploited by the Hollywood system. This is a shot from Ayoka Chenzira, who makes her films in New York. This film is called Hairpiece, and it's a short animated film which has to do with the way in which black women have wanted to conform and to make their hair behave the way white hair behaves, in quotes. But the end of the film is to show the variety of black female beauty, which you see here. That's it. I'm not going to show you any more slides. I want you to see the film. The film A Different Image, as I told you, was completed in 1982, and it is a provocative account of a young black woman and her friendship with a young black man, which is threatened by his capitulation to peer pressure and to the culture's sexism and racism. Now, she's going to run the film. It's under an hour. And I'd like to hear some of your responses to that. Before I do that, do you have any questions about this sort of history of the world in 3 minutes? I just wanted to give you a sense. I know that most of these are probably images that you have seen so many times before that seeing them again is not going to change your world view. But yeah, do you have any questions? Hairpiece is Ayoka Chenzira. C-H-E-N-Z-I-R-A. And Ayoka is in Brooklyn. She's made several very interesting films, and we thought was going to end up getting a lot of money because she was picked by Robert Redford to go out to Sundance and do some writing. And we thought that when she finished that script that, you know, the $5 million was going to be in her lap. And it is still not forthcoming. She's done another really lovely film on Sevilla, the dance teacher who was her teacher. A number of these women are extremely talented. Ayoka is herself a dancer. But this animated film is wonderful. I've shown it so many times, and even the men enjoy it because it does not eliminate men from this picture. Yeah. Filmmaker Foundation in New York did distribute it. Now, Ayoka may be distributing it herself now. But, yeah, sure. I'll give you whatever information I can about that. Do you have any other questions? Okay. I wanted to say one thing about Louise Beavers. You see her almost always in these, you know, whatever she is with the kind of loyalty to the white mistress. But there was a film that was made in the 40s by a white filmmaker in Atlanta. And I've just turned up this film. What's exciting about this whole area is that some of these films are just surfacing. I mean, films that we haven't seen since they were shown, you know, the year they were released. And this film is called Reform School. And Louise Beavers becomes the director of this school. She runs this operation of these young men. And there is no big love business. There's no romance to it. She is like the warden. And she solves the problems of these kids. Now, at the same time she was in Hollywood doing these things with the aprons and the head rags, she was actually having an opportunity with these independent films to star in a film and show the kind of roles she could actually play that had something to do with what real women did. Okay, here is a different image.
Now you can
thank you.
Some of the some of the women working on that who are doing some really kind of avant-garde things. You know, this is fairly traditional in terms of some of the but who are kind of on the cutting edge of new ideas and so on. But they range in variety, just as the individuals do. Kathleen Collins, who's from the City University of New York, has done some very interesting films. And I took her film Losing Ground to Yugoslavia a few years ago. And some of you know that film. You'd be interested in the reaction. This was a group of women in Zagreb, connected with the University of Zagreb, who are very articulate in terms of English. So you may have problems with understanding the language of the film. And they are mainly feminists in various areas of social sciences. And they were quite disappointed in the film. Do you know what the issues for that is? They thought that it wasn't really a bad film. Because the woman was the protagonist in this film isn't around, is a black woman who's quite light-skinned, and she is a philosophy professor at a university, and she's married to an artist who is completely the opposite, and certainly the antithesis of her in terms of feeling and attitude, who's sort of free and open. And it has some wonderful moments of humor as well. And they have no problem about money. They don't live in the ghetto. There's no urban violence or anything else to it. And they wanted to know what was that. It was extraordinary. It just appeared to them. Because they didn't feel that it was anything different from any film that would be made by perhaps any woman, or as some of them said, by any man. And, you know, what I would say to them, what exactly did you expect? What came out was clearly what you expected, and stereotypical version of the because they were very proud about the diversity of the perhaps not the they are very well read when it comes to politics and sexual politics. But it is interesting how now we focus on it. Yeah, I did. I took two black girls to China last year. That was interesting. One by Charles Lane. Which is a really advanced film, which is something from the science and wonderful interpretation of Black women's experience with slavery, in particular, I guess. And that was important in the evidence of it was really thrilling. The Black and White film was an experimental film. It was done silently, except for the music. So I figured there wouldn't be any problem with comprehension. And I showed it in a film studio in Chicago. And there were 400 people, a sudden 400 people audience, you know, sort of from above, and they smoked through it and talked through it. And I don't know how many of them actually understood what was going on, but I had an interpreter. And I kept saying to the interpreter, ask them if they had any comments or any questions. Nothing, absolutely nothing. I couldn't get, you know, any sort of audience response, but all they did was applaud. And they got up and they went back to editing or shooting or whatever else they were doing at the studio. And I got to see three films in various stages of production. And you know, it was kind of a whole day, extraordinary experience. And I never had any sense of what was going on with them. But I showed it next in a studio. About 350 students, there's so many metamorphosed to see these films. There, I actually got some response, But they're not used to reacting. They're not used to, in a classroom, they sit there and they think, oh, I'm not going to do that. But they're not used to the sort of interaction that we have in the classroom. So I use it like, oh, that's about these it takes. Instead of the first person next to me, I used to take. So it, by the third time I showed it, it really began to change some of the reactions. And I must admit that they were no more ill-informed than the audience in the surroundings. So that they were very open to what they saw. I've never seen a film made. And I would venture to say that they had not seen any mainstream things before. I don't think that the helicopter was in the
it's funny because I was just thinking about being in, I was the first person to make a comment, and everybody said something about the fact that, well, maybe the way in which she was acting is something that you really can't do because I didn't feel the nature of it. And I remember quickly being cut off of one of the guys, and you know, being completely put down, and I thought, well, maybe I was wrong, and it seemed like the second time today, I did feel much more sympathetic to her. But I still, still feel that one has to conform to a certain extent of the society. I mean, maybe that's just a cop-out thing, I don't know, but we do exist in a society, and I mean, unless more people change, then I mean, one person in one country or a small group of people in one country, and if maybe a small group of people have to start out to make it so that it would be a chain reaction, I don't know.
No, I think she's saying that there has to be an adjustment. I think she really has to be more adjustment. She needs an adjustment.
I think that so far, probably the only way to change things is if one great person goes out and starts doing it, and then others might follow suit. It might be really hard and long, but that's the way, like Rosa Parks, you know, sitting in front of the bus and stuff. And just a comment on what maybe a lot of learned and what we also learned is that maybe, unfortunately, she can't show that side of her to everybody. She does have to make a compromise, but that she can judge who she can show that side to, and that she can possibly bring influence on people's lives like him to change perceptions so that she can act openly and care for people. And in terms of him, I think that it's similar. Like he's learning from her and then looking himself into other cultures and stuff, but this is not necessarily the way to always act and look at things. And so he's sort of changing too and making compromises.
And I
sort of reaching crisis and conflict and learning from him.
And I think there's this sense of bringing each other strength. You know, that he lends her courage, and so some of these things that Ralph is, you know, really trying to deal with him, he can begin to resist that. I really like the scene of the two men sitting together, because Ralph had learned, and he deserts his friend, which I think is
just
weird.
The fact that he tries to support those friends,
yes.
He kind of up and left, and he realizes that the only person at that point, I'm doing this, that other people that like that film, that you can only get that from her, you know.
So there is an interesting romantic moment.
I'm very amazed with that, with everything showing constant and involved, and because there's both of us, and we have to perform a certain way in a society, and even if there is this personation that goes across, like, you know, you need more person, but then again, going across, you're the first person to do that, you know, it's just the way our society works, the way the time is changing, the way everything is being knit together in order to make this world.
Yeah, I love her spirit.
You can do that, but it's back at the Women Theological Center.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So if you like, do you want to give me? I could call you. I'm leaving in the morning, but I could get it.
Okay.
To you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
I can find Karen Peace at the Donovan Library.
Oh, okay. Because I'm going to give her.
Thank you.